This is Wang.
Mrs. Wang, are you with us?
I am paying attention.
Now, you may only see a pile of receipts, but I see a story. I can see where this story is going. It does not look good.
What's happening?
You're listening to Because You Watched with Charlie and Francesco. I'm Charlie.
And I'm Francesco.
This is a podcast where we take a film that enjoyed significant mainstream success and use them as a starting point to discuss lesser-known films that we think deserve greater attention.
Well, too bad my attention span is so small today. I keep getting distracted by all these other universes in my head.
What's the difference between Alpha Francesco and Prime Francesco?
Alpha Francesco doesn't wear glasses. we're joined today by a wonderful guest, David Rosen from Piecing It Together podcast. David, how about you introduce yourself to our listeners?
I mean, you just introduced him.
Well, you know, from your own mouth.
You did, but sure, I will. Thank you so much for having me, guys. I'm David Rosen from the Piecing It Together podcast, where we take a look at a movie through the lens of what other movies might have inspired it, which actually isn't that too dissimilar from what ends up happening here in a way, since, you know, the kind of you guys' setup leads to these recommendations for other movies, which is kind of the basic goal with what we're doing over there, too.
So what you're saying is we copied you.
Nah, there's plenty of room for conversations that lead to awesome recommendations for other movies.
So what you're saying is that Piecing It Together might have been a piece for Because You Watched, in a way.
Hey, I like that. There you go. Puzzle pieces in the conversation already. Let's do it.
And because you listened to Because You Watched, your pick might be Piecing It Together.
Okay, that's too much. That's too many layers.
Very heady here. Yeah.
Too multiversal.
Yeah.
So, David, I suppose what our audience want to know most about you is, do you have any pets?
Oh my God. I have four pets. Yes. I've got a dog named Harvey and three cats. We've got Millie, Trudy, and Niaguri. And they are my life, basically. I love them. The only thing I love more than movies. So.
Oh, wow. Well,
do you now regret naming your dog after Harvey Weinstein?
That's literally what he's named after, by the way.
Oh, my God. Really?
You're making a joke, but that is what we named him, Harvey Weinstein, 15 years ago. And yeah, we don't bring that up too often anymore. But since you brought it up, that is exactly.
Well, it's good to have one good Harvey in the world left.
Yes.
One good
That's
boy.
Right.
I hope it's a really ugly dog.
Yeah. No. He looks like a little old man. It's perfect. It's he embodies it, but in a good way, though.
Okay,
on to today's film.
All right. So the film we're talking about today is the 2022 Oscar-winning, mind-bending picture directed by Daniel Kwan and Daniel Scheinert, Everything, Everywhere, All at Once. Evelyn Wang, an aging Chinese immigrant, is swept up in an insane adventure where she alone can save what's important to her by connecting with the lives she could have led in other universes.
Do you know that before the film's release, to keep it spoiler free, the IMDb synopsis just read, a 55-year-old Chinese woman does her taxes?
Yeah. I think I remember that too, because yeah, I mean, I was so looking forward to this movie, and I remember that synopsis and being like, what are they doing now? Like, you know.
So all three of us, we saw it when it was in cinemas.
Yeah,
I know it was released earlier in the States than it was in the UK. I'm curious, just because I know that you really like Swiss Army Man. What drew your excitement to this film? Was it the Daniels or was it Michelle Yeoh?
It was definitely more Daniels. Like, I respect Michelle Yeoh and like have seen a good number of things that she's done over the years, but definitely I am, like, you know, an admitted A24 fanboy, and like, you know, and I like you said, Swiss Army Man was literally my number one favorite movie of 2016, and so I had been waiting for them to do something else, and when I heard Michelle Yeoh was gonna be in it, that's awesome. Keeley Kwan's gonna be in it, like, what? That's great, you know. And like, so everything about it just sounded awesome, and so I was just super excited.
Yeah, I was very excited to see it. I've not seen Swiss Army Man, but I knew by reputation, largely from their music video directing.
Yeah, sure.
Sort of the sensibility of the Daniels. And I am a very big Michelle Yeoh fan from before this film, even though I think probably my introduction to her work was Crazy Rich Asians. Before that, I think Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon is almost definitely one of the top martial arts films of all time. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And partly because of the work that she's doing in that. And I just also have a lot of respect for her at this time, when we're living in a time where action movies and stunt choreography is feeling a lot more lackluster. And we'll get more into this when we get to my pick. But the fact that there are people like Michelle Yeoh or Jackie Chan or even Jean-Claude Van Damme who are these real go-for-it martial artists, mm-hmm. and whose films are above and beyond because of their dedication to choreography.
Yeah, and those are just the ones that, I mean, talking specifically about Michelle Yeoh and Jackie Chan, broke through in the States. But the Hong Kong martial arts film industry is such a goldmine,
yeah.
of like some of the best action choreography ever.
And also was so ahead of its time and so groundbreaking. So not just is it creating amazing stuff, but it created stuff that it took Hollywood years to catch up with.
Mm.
And yeah, now is unfortunately gone past and seemed to have left in the dirt. Although I'm very excited for John Wick 4, which I am seeing this weekend.
I was about to say that too. Yeah, like I think, not to go on a tangent or anything, but between Everything Everywhere All at Once is success and John Wick Chapter 4 is going to do incredible numbers at the time we're recording right now. I think maybe we'll get a little bit of an extra light shined on, you know, some of the originators of this kind of stuff. And I know I certainly want to seek out more of it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, speaking of John Wick, I do feel a bit like at least the first John Wick and Everything Everywhere, they have a similar arc as Star Vehicles, because it's during this very resurgent period in both stars' careers. And, you know, it's in both cases, they're actors who might be considered a bit past their prime and then turning up and doing these amazingly impressive action set pieces that sort of put the $200 million blockbusters to shame in a lot of cases. And also being unexpected runaway successes at the box office.
Mm-hmm. Well, on to Everything Everywhere All at Once. Well, to answer the question you were asking earlier about its release, I wasn't really that aware of it until its release. It was when the reviews started exploding everywhere that I was like, oh, wait, this came out. It almost caught me by surprise. But what do we think of this film?
I cry every time I watch it.
Uh-huh.
In genuinely, I think that for all its wackiness, which I know, we were talking off mic, that's for David's main reservation about it. Mm. I think I can deal with the wackiness because to me, at its heart is something that is so devastating in a lot of ways that I sort of need the wackiness to not be so overwhelmed by the central conflict of the film between Evelyn and Joy.
Yeah. I also think the film does a good job of internally justifying its wackiness. Like I thought the premise of having to do something highly improbable in order to be able to jump between universes was a good justification for what is essentially a lot of very random out there humor that it's very hit and miss most of the time it's tried.
And not to like, just, you know, as the being the one who is like complaining a little bit about the level of wackiness here. I mean, like I said, I love Swiss Army Man. I love wackiness. I just think it maybe tilts the needle a little too far at times into that direction. Whereas, if it had been maybe reined in a little bit, I would have liked it even more. But make no mistake, for anyone listening, I am not on the backlash train that you'll see all over film Twitter right now, especially since the Oscar win. I still love this movie and it's still great.
Do you think that, I mean, I'm sure this was part of your reaction when you first saw the film, but even when you saw it, you know, it was being hyped and being very well reviewed and was already very popular. Do you think that if this was a more obscure niche hobbyist film, it might feel a bit more iconoclastic rather than sort of, oh, look at this crazy thing we can do. Do you think the film's success can make the wackiness feel a bit
pandering?
Yeah, exactly. Pandering is the right word.
Right. Yeah. To me personally, no, only because I think it kind of already is more of a small, weird, indie kind of movie. I mean, granted, A24 isn't really indie, you know, it's still, I'm not sure, I didn't write down the budget here, but, you know, it's still a relatively, you know, small budget compared to blockbuster type movies that usually get all the attention, especially nowadays. But, you know, it's still technically an indie. It's still small. It's still weird. It's still out there. And I think a lot of people, you know, as big as it is, I think a lot of people haven't seen it or don't know much about it up until the Oscars happened.
I don't think it was expected to be this much of a success.
But that's my point. I mean, even before the Oscars, it was clear that the level of success it was attaining was unusual.
Right. Yeah,
for
absolutely.
This sort of film. And I think, I guess what I was trying to ask with my question was if it had more of the arc that you might expect, more of a similar arc to, say, Swiss Army Man, do you think it would have bothered you less?
I don't know. I don't know. And it's definitely a difficult question because the movie, one thing I noticed actually, and like, you know, I don't want to talk about our other movies that we're going to discuss here yet, but like something I noticed is how wacky some of them are. I mean, you know what I mean? So it's kind of, it is kind of par for the course for this genre that this movie is celebrating. So I think it fits a lot better. And I think it kind of makes me appreciate where they're coming from more in what they're trying to do with all of that, like, just straight up ridiculousness.
Yeah. And I think my philosophy to that is more of a, this film doesn't need me to defend or champion it. Swiss Army Man maybe does. You know, if a film is more broadly underappreciated, I feel less keen to shit on it unless it deserves it. Whereas if everyone likes the film and it won every single Oscar, then it's not like I want to take it down a peg, but more like, okay, let's add some nuance to the discussion.
Sure.
One of David's cats just came into frame. Which cat is that?
That is Millie. And
oh, hello, Millie.
Doesn't mess with anything here. We'll see what happens.
That's very cute.
So I saw this film twice. I saw it once when it came out here in the UK, and then I saw it again yesterday evening before recording. And it was interesting watching it twice. The first time, it felt a bit overlong. It felt like a lot of the scenes were very meandering and were a bit filler. This time around, because I already knew where it was going, it felt a lot tighter. And actually, a lot of the very almost tangential, meandering scenes where we jump into other universes or we cut to a fight that's not really advancing the plot, they still felt integral to what the narrative needed, and it felt much, much tighter. Something that didn't hit as hard was the emotional stuff the second time around, which I know was clearly not the case with you, Charlie. But the scene where Waymond goes, in another life, I would have loved to do laundry and taxes with you, always hits me.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, but also that final conversation that Joy and Evelyn have by the car at the New Year party. It just, she says every time we see each, something to the effect of every time we see each other, we just make each other unhappy and I want it to stop. And it just, luckily, I don't think I have that relationship with my parents, but I fully empathize with that sort of dynamic with people in your life. Mm-hmm. And it is really hard, and ending any sort of close relationship is extremely hard, and you do feel the full weight of that, both from everything that's come before in the film and the journey that Evelyn has gone on with a different version of her daughter. Mm-hmm. And also the writing, I think, does take a breath from the craziness in that scene. And just the performances of Stephanie Hsu and Michelle Yeoh are just heart-wrenching.
And Oscar winner.
Ke-hee Kwan.
No, Jamie Lee Curtis.
Yeah, but she's not in that conversation.
Oh, true. Oh, I thought you were talking about the whole film.
No. I just meant in that conversation. Look, I've said stuff about Jamie Lee Curtis's Oscar win, and I don't mind her having a career Oscar. I just think that her performance in this is very good.
And she doesn't have that much to do.
No, and she is clearly like giving it her all. And I think that later in the film, she has some really nice moments. But to me, if it wouldn't feel so egregious if she wasn't nominated alongside Stephanie Hsu, who is sensationalist. I mean, I've loved Stephanie Hsu since I saw her in The Marvelous Mrs. Maisel, where she is really funny and really cool. Whereas in this, she takes it to a whole new level and is playing so many dimensions of essentially two different versions of the same character, if not two different characters altogether, and is the sort of, to me, the runaway star of the film. And that's not to say that Michelle Yeoh and Ke-hee Kwan don't deserve all the plaudits they get. I think this film doesn't work without everyone giving the performances they give, but there is something so powerful about what Stephanie Hsu is doing throughout the film and how she is fully keyed into the humor of the script as well. I think all the performances are great, but I just think that when I watch Jamie Lee Curtis in this film, in the context of her having won an Oscar for this film, it just feels weird.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think everything...
Everywhere All at Once?
Everything Everywhere All at Once. getting into the Oscar conversation doesn't happen without the mother-daughter relationship. Like, and so Stephanie Hsu and Michelle Yeoh, like, that really is the most important part. Even though all the multiversal stuff is a blast and is weird and fun and cool, it doesn't become a movie other than some weird kind of indie oddity without that relationship. And I think that relationship is what speaks to so many people. And so, yeah, I mean, those are the most important performances.
And the fact that the villain could have so easily been an interdimensional monster, just an entity to defeat,
which she set up as.
Which obviously she is, but then that entity is incorporated within the narrative of the characters. And it's just, it's not just Jobu Tupacu, who happens to also be Joy. It's Jobu Tupacu, who was created as a product of the relationship between Evelyn and Joy. So it's like... I like how the film links everything back together to the central emotional core and never quite lets go of it, despite all of its like meanderings.
Yeah, and I suppose if we're going around saying if we have any reservations with this film, because look, this film is extremely successful and I really love it, but it's won Best Picture, so I feel like...
It's won 7 Oscars.
Yeah, but particularly Best Picture somehow, despite being a film in which a fight occurs with butt plugs and sex toys, but which, wild, it's a new era.
Relatable.
Yeah.
So I suppose I have a slight reservation about some of the narrative, more than I do about the weirdness, is that there are sort of two resolutions with Evelyn's arc throughout the story. Is her resolution of understanding that she needs to change her relationship with her daughter and also learn to appreciate the things she loves about her husband, Waymond. And I feel like we need to set aside like a whole 5 minutes to talk about how good Kei Kwan is in this film. But if I have a reservation, it's that those two arcs are sort of happening separately and those two realizations are sort of happening separately rather than being taken in the context of how they function as a three. Mm. Because like we do see that Joy and Waymond have a very warm relationship in comparison to her relationship with Evelyn. But it's never interrogated how Joy feels about the way Evelyn treats her husband or why Waymond doesn't call Evelyn out more for the way she treats Joy.
And there's a lot of time in the climax that is taken up by her reconciliation with Jamie Lee Curtis's character, which is necessary for the plot, but maybe does take away some time from...
Where that could happen.
Yeah.
It's just, the main thing is that you have these two arcs that on paper should be very intertwined, and they just sort of feel like they happen too separately from a narrative perspective. And I'm not fully sure why that is, but it's something to think about. And I think it's maybe a lot of the criticisms that we're seeing on film Twitter, which if such a place could exist and have any problems at all, are maybe disingenuous. But I think this isn't a problem, but it's maybe something to, you know, consider. And how part of Evelyn's problem is that she doesn't view herself as part of an intertwined machine. Rather, she's at the center of her world and she's having to deal with her father. She's having to deal with her daughter. She's having to deal with her husband, rather than dealing with how all these parts are interacting together.
And if I have one problem with the film, and after this they're going to revoke all of its Oscars because we're just demolishing it. But my point is that if I have only one problem with this film, and maybe I have a couple, but if I have one problem with this film is a lot of the humor is referential. And that's something that it's fine, and I'm glad the film isn't referencing things that are only relevant right now, and then in a year we'll have all, you know, forgotten about.
Because Always Sunny is going to be on the air for the next 30 years.
Yeah, well, you know, it's referencing, you know, things that are already part of the, you know, general consciousness. But still, so much of this film is referential. And while I think it's all fun, I'm not sure if it's a style of comedy that I can vibe with all that much when it just permeates the entire film, even the emotional scenes, like even the scene with Wayman that he shot like a Wong Kar-wai movie is just a reference to Wong Kar-wai movies.
Yeah, but it works. Here's where I sort of disagree with you. I don't know if it's so much a disagreement, but it's a nuance I want to add. My problem has always been with references is when if you take away understanding the reference, does the joke, does the scene, does the moment still work? If you've never seen a Wong Kar-wai film, that scene still hits hard. But you watching it as someone with a lot of knowledge of Hong Kong cinema know that he is specifically made up to look like Tony Leung in The Mood for Love.
Yeah, and well, there's the ongoing Ratatouille joke, but once again, that's kind of set up in the film itself, and then it's delivered as a punchline, so that's good.
Yeah, I suppose that's one that you do need to know Ratatouille, but it's like a very popular... But the joke isn't that, oh, here's Ratatouille. The joke is that she has forgotten that it's a rat and not a raccoon.
Yeah. But no, you're right. It's not... Again, I still find the film very funny because exactly as you said, you take away the references, the jokes still land and a lot of the humor still lands. I'm still... I don't know, like... I said this in our Oscars reaction episode. I think the film is better than the sum of its parts. If you take one scene out of it, I'm not sure if it works all that well. It's like, oh, this is a parody of Ratatouille. That's cute. This is a scene where people fight with butt plugs in their butts. That's fun. But it doesn't stick with me too hard. When you piece it all together and it fits together so neatly and so cohesively, then you're like, okay, that's impressive, actually.
I just want to correct you. The fight doesn't occur with butt plugs in their butts. It's awards shaped like butt plugs in their
true.
Butts.
That's
technically.
Technically. Yeah. Just don't want to get in trouble there.
Yeah.
But sorry, I feel like because we all sort of went around and said what we didn't like, that we spent a lot of time together talking about our reservations, but I still really like this film, and I think it was possibly my favorite film of the last year, which in hindsight is sort of weird to remember that, oh, before like it got this, you know, very institutional mainstream success, it was a film. I mean, it still is a film, but it's a film that I came to on my own and then a lot of other people embraced.
I remember watching Parasite, having to scour for a digital copy before it came out in the UK because I was so excited to watch it, and then it just exploded, and you know, it didn't feel as special anymore, but it doesn't mean that it didn't deserve the success that it got.
I think part of what makes this film so fun, as well as all the emotional beats that we have, is that part of it is predicated on what it must be to realize how awesome it is to be Michelle Yeoh. Because a lot of the skills she accesses, like singing, being, you know, being a movie star, being a martial artist, it's stuff that is true of Michelle Yeoh, and they even use clips from the red carpet, the premiere of Crazy Rich Asians with real life Michelle Yeoh. So there is something really fun about Michelle Yeoh, who, if you've seen her in real life, is an extremely confident and high status presence, playing someone that, you know, isn't necessarily low status in so much of an insecure way, but is someone who you sort of wouldn't look twice at, who then realizes she has the potential to be as cool as the actress who is deliberately playing her.
Yeah, my favorite part of the movie is the fact that it's revealed that like the reason why she was chosen is because she's the only version of herself that has no special talent, so she's like an open vessel for all of these talents, which, I mean, if that's not a meta commentary on an actor, I mean,
completely.
What it is, you know?
And it's like, it is, she is so one of a kind because she is the one version of Michelle Yeoh that didn't become a great success in some way, shape or form.
To think that they originally wanted Jackie Chan for this, how much
I don't think it would have been, I mean, we can't know if it would have been worse. I think it would have just been a very, very different film. And I think it would have hinged more on the midlife crisis aspect of it, which is obviously a much more male-coded thing to occur to someone, rather than a very specific mother-daughter dynamic, obviously. Or whether he would have sort of taken the role, he would have had more in common with the Wayman role, but that role then be more central to the narrative. So, I mean, it's impossible to know. And
well, a lot of the original impetus of the film was making a film about ADHD. And you can still see a lot of that in the final version, where not only is her jumping between universes coded as distractedness by the people around her, but also even before she starts jumping into universes, we see her being very hyperactive, very almost and aware of what the people around her are feeling or saying.
I also think, not to get too much into the film that didn't happen, I think there is something that makes Michelle Yeoh in this role work better than Jackie Chan might, particularly in action sequences. Because if you watch Jackie Chan films, they're sort of all about, he's not bumbling, but the comedy is from him scrambling and improvising. Whereas Michelle Yeoh's fighting style in most of her films is extremely balletic and extremely confident and extremely controlled. And I think that once Evelyn accesses the martial arts abilities of her other selves, her body needs to act like someone who is totally confident in their abilities. And even in films where it's not relevant to the plot, I've seen Jackie Chan still sort of play that frantic, improvisational, more comic style, whereas I think the comedy in the fight scenes in Everything Everywhere All at Once comes from how serious she is with the absurdity of the environment, rather than her visibly noticing how absurd everything is.
So does anyone have any final thoughts before we move on to the next film?
Just Kehi Kwan looks damn good in a tux.
Yeah, David?
I think it was a great movie to be such a huge Oscar success.
Yeah, and we're not done talking about it, but we're about to move on to our first alternate. Where can I stream Everything Everywhere All at Once if I want to? And don't say I can just stream it Everything Everywhere and All at Once, because that joke only works once per episode.
But also, you don't have the bandwidth to watch it Everything Everywhere All at Once, because it would just take up a lot of data.
The headphones we're wearing look strikingly similar to the things that they use to dimension travel in
the
they
film. Do I hadn't noticed that, except they don't glow. Okay, you can stream this on Prime Video, you can rent it on Amazon, Google Play, Microsoft, YouTube, Rakuten TV, Curzon, Home Cinema, Apple TV, and Sky Store, and you can buy it on all those platforms except for Curzon Home Cinema. All right, moving on to our next film.
Goodbye!
Love in the Time of Twilight, a 1995 film directed by Tsui Hark. Like many young people of the 1920s, Kong and Yan are infected with the happily ever after syndrome, waiting for their perfect match. Unlike other love stories, this couple journeys through murder, ghostly spirits, and through sacrifice, all in the name of love. Thank you so much to my partner for suggesting this as a pick. It was impossible to find online. We had to jump through hoops to get available to, you know, all the three of us, for all the three of us to watch. But now that you've seen it, you understand why I picked it for this episode, right?
Oh, absolutely. And it's such a good pick and was such an enjoyable film. So thank you, Loris, for choosing it.
Yeah.
What do you think, David?
I had a lot of fun with this movie. It's just absolutely ridiculous. It's kind of like a live action Looney Tunes movie.
I was saying the exact same thing about a few of, actually most of these films are live action cartoons in some way, but especially this one when you get into the ghost stuff.
To give a bit of a better premise, because the Letterboxd synopsis doesn't actually talk about the plot at all, and you know, we're gonna be entering into some thematic spoilers of what happens, I would say, like 20 minutes into the film. It's kind of the same as Everything Everywhere if you think about it, where the two protagonists, where she works an opera company, which is, they call it Cantonese opera. They wear costumes and makeup that is more reminiscent of Peking or Beijing opera. It's not a historical realist film, let's put it like that. But yeah, she works in an opera theater. He's a bank teller. They run into each other where she's trying to steal some stuff from a street vendor. He bumps into her, gets her caught. And from there, it's like a, you know, they're like cats and dogs. They ate each other. But at one point, we get to this scene where both of them get drunk with some respective partners. She's got this creepy friend. He's got this woman who's trying to seduce him. And then we cut. We don't know what happened overnight. And he comes back as a ghost, tells her he's been killed, and takes her into the dimensional ghost world to go back to the day when he was skilled to try and undo things. So there's a lot of dimension hopping. They meet other versions of themselves in the past. We see all of the different branches of what could happen if things happened differently. So it's not quite a multiverse film. It's more of a ghost time travel film, but it does touch on a lot of the same elements.
You mentioned them being like cats and dogs. I was sort of reminded of the sort of first chunk of When Harry Met Sally,
a film which I haven't seen somehow.
Have you seen it, David?
It's been a long time, but yeah, I could see that though, with like that kind of back and forth, you know, rom-com, will they, won't they kind of thing.
It's a screwball comedy thing, right?
It is. And also, like, you know, you've got male stuff like that, which is sort of based on the chemistry that these two lovers show while ostensibly hating each other. Yeah. It's like a very good trope to use in a story like this. Yeah.
Or the original, you've got male, The Shop Around the Corner by Lubitsch, which was a screwball comedy.
That's true.
Yeah. But another thing that makes it so similar to Everything Everywhere is the role of the male lead, Kong, played by Nicky Wu, who starts off as this white collar meek, like wears glasses, very unassuming, but then he comes back as a ghost and is this wily, world weary expert guy who guides her through the interdimensional travel.
He's literally a spirit guide.
He is, and it's like the same transformation that we see Waymond go through at the beginning of Everything Everywhere.
Yeah, I was also thinking of like Beetlejuice, like various like movies where like a ghost like kind of interacts with the world and like messes with the people.
But specifically Alec Baldwin in Beetlejuice rather than Beetlejuice himself, in my opinion.
Sure. No, that you're absolutely right.
Because he's not an anarchic ghost.
Right, right, exactly. He's there for a reason to try to like kind of solve the crime, basically, in a way. But another reason why I thought it was a great pick for this conversation is, you know, the mixing of genres, because like to get that kind of ghost story, to get that kind of screwball romantic comedy, to get the wacky Looney Tunes-ish, you know, kind of tone that we've got here, all these different genres, that's something that absolutely Everything Everywhere All at Once is doing, between all of its craziness versus, you know, like we said, the Warcry stuff, you know, any of, you know, the kind of different genres that it's playing in, you kind of get a lot of that here.
Yeah. And, you know, not all of it works. I think Everything Everywhere is a bit more of a cohesive unit than this film is. Also, the not all the CGI has aged incredibly, but I find it such a charming film to look at. And I think some of the very obvious special effects that it uses work to its advantage in a weird way.
But I mean, there are a lot of ways we can compare it, but it does sort of feel a bit like Everything Everywhere All at Once in that it feels, at least to my eyes, I don't know how it might be received in Asia, but a very original film and a very original concept.
Well, this is by the same director who made Once Upon a Time in China, which I think is his most famous film outside of Hong Kong. But this comes out in 1995, so it's well after the heyday of, you know, the Hong Kong martial arts, the golden age, you know, of the Hong Kong cinema history. And I think in this period, there were a lot of comedies that were coming out that were very hit and miss, that relied on humor that is now very dated, a lot of jokes around sexual harassment, a lot of racial jokes. This film,
it does kind that of, to a bit.
Does that, but kind of reverses it. Like, there's one scene where it does look like it's leading up to some like guy peeping on girl in the shower gag that's played for laughs. But then that's reversed. First of all, it doesn't happen, and second of all, the guy is made fun of it regardless. So he's still the butt of the joke regardless of what happens or doesn't happen. So it doesn't feel exploitative, but it does feel like it's playing around those tropes, but like skirting around them at the last minute.
I think that's very fair. I mean, you bring us on to the humor and the character, I think, Little Shrimp,
yeah.
Now, I get that this is a film from the 90s, and I also get this is a film from a country with its own cultural shorthand and its own sense of humor. I did feel like some of the humor, particularly around that character, fell a bit flat for me.
Yeah, well, he's the one I mentioned earlier.
Yeah.
Who's constantly the butt of every joke and who's constantly played for laughs. And that can be very hit and miss when you have one character whose role is just to be. He's also annoying. Like, he's not the funny guy in the comedy duo.
Yeah, he's not like you're endeared to. He's not a wisecracker.
No, you're meant to find him annoying, but that has kind of a negative effect on the humor overall.
And like, just to be clear, so the actor Eric Cotman-Fey, who plays Little Shrimp, this isn't a reflection on his performance. I just think it's more what that kind of character is, and just that it's maybe not a cup of tea. I also don't, there is just sort of a pattern in this film of making fat people the butt of the joke, and it happens not just with that character but with another character, and it just feels, the repetition makes it feel deliberate, even if it's not.
Yeah, but you know, that was also a thing in American cinema until like the day before yesterday. Sure. So yeah, up until the 2010s, I would say.
I think to an extent it's still a problem everywhere. Yeah. So that isn't a reflection on problems I have with Asian cinema. Just, I don't know, just
it's,
that. Just
it's
that
a film from 1995, but the thing I want to bring attention to is the fact that, you know, I'm not, you know, the biggest defender of this film. I really like this
film. It doesn't
film.
Need you to defend it. It's a good film.
The thing I want to bring attention to is the fact that if you watch other comedies from the same era made in Hong Kong, they are much worse in all of those respects that you just brought up. So this was actually kind of an outlier probably when it came out.
I think the two leads, so Nicky Wu and Charlie Young, who play Kong and Yan Yan, are both brilliant. Mm-hmm. And they have so much chemistry. And they also have to like Michelle Yeoh, Ke-hee Kwan, and Stephanie Hsu, different versions of the same character. In this, it's more past versions of themselves from 2 weeks before the main events of the film. And I think it's such a credit to them. I mean, less so with Nicky Wu, because there are visual signifiers that he's a different character. But with her, who is playing a character that by and large looks the same from scene to scene, whether it's the past or the present version. Or I should say the present and the future version, because it's not her past. She's not traveling from the past to the future. She's future. Not important. Is that despite not having any obvious visual signifiers, her performance is modulated so subtly that you know exactly which version of her is which, while it is still believable that characters who don't understand what's going on mistake one for the other. Mm-hmm. So it's such a fine needle to thread, and I think she does it so wonderfully that I just wanted to shout that out.
Yeah. We were kind of talking about some of the humor that doesn't hold up, you know, to today. I did write down one joke that I think is timeless. when the main guy, Kong, is saying to Yan Yan, let me tell you what happened to me. And then this music starts and she goes, oh, you're going to sing a story to me? And he goes, that's your father's playing music outside.
It's very Mel Brooks.
Yeah.
Mel Brooks.
It's never not funny when music that you think is non-diegetic is then revealed to be diegetic.
Yeah.
Have you seen Hot Rod?
You know what? Surprisingly, no, I never have.
Yeah. There's this great bit where there's like this inspirational song going on, and Andy Samberg and Bill Hader and Joe Matacone are all walking down the street really triumphantly to go to the climax of the film that will decide everything. And there's this song playing in the background, and then the camera sort of pans and it shows like there's just some people on the street who are singing the song.
Well, it's the same gag in Blazing Saddles.
That's true.
That's why I brought up Mel Brooks.
Yeah, it always makes me think of Hot Rod, and it's one of the best needle drops in any film, the way that it's done in that. That's a really great film.
Yeah, but as a last point from me on Love in the Time of Twilight, I would say that this film is a similar structure to Everything Everywhere in that you have an almost like traditional action movie plot. We mentioned earlier that this is like investigation. He has to prevent his own murder. And there is a clear villain who is just, unlike Jobu Topaki, like unabashedly villainous. But the true core of the film is the love relationship between the two of them. And I don't think the two cohes as well in this as they do in Everything Everywhere, the, you know, more action movie, Defeat the Big Bad Guy, and the, you know, central emotional story. But I don't necessarily need them to, you know, they're films that were made almost 30 years apart from each other. They have different sensibilities. And my last point is that there is almost this theme of no matter which universe they find themselves in, they're always destined to fall in love. And it's something very similar to Evelyn and Waymond in a way where, well, part of the universe where she marries Jamie Lee Curtis and they have sausage fingers or
But she goes
fingers.
To leave Jamie Lee Curtis.
No, but then they're together by the end.
Yeah, well, true. I'm just saying they're having trouble.
Yeah, but, sure. They're reconciled. Waymond wants to divorce her at the beginning of the film.
No, he doesn't. He wants her to think that divorce is on the table so they can have an actual conversation. It's a very stupid plan.
Well, no, actually, it tells you that he's tried to have the conversation before and she always brushed him off. I think it's what...
Yeah, he really doesn't want to divorce. He really doesn't want a divorce, which is why he's showing her the divorce papers.
But it's like, I was kind of hoping for something like that to happen in Everything Everywhere, where she goes to all these different universes and somehow Waymond is always there to tell her what to do. And it's the case in the universe where she is the real Michelle Yeoh and he is Tony Leung. But yeah, we're missing that from the Rebecca Cooney universe and from the Jamie Lee Curtis universe. That's probably why I didn't like those universes as much. They felt more like gags than, you know.
Yeah, they're just throwaways, basically.
Yeah, there's no Waymond. What's the point?
Yeah. Because she's able to find out what's at the heart of all the people that she's having trouble with in her universe.
Do they all have raccoons in their
Well,
hats?
One of them does.
Okay.
It's like he doesn't know that he can be
someone
without help. He doesn't know that he can
when
be
she's
good
enough. She's going up the stairs and she's like fixing everyone's problems.
That's why you need those. Yeah. Because also...
There's a submissive guy that she spanks. Yeah, no, you're right.
She doesn't necessarily belong with Waymond in every universe, but Waymond has the potential to make her happy. And, you know, I think Waymond could make anyone happy.
Yeah.
He's a nice boy.
But these two guys belong with each other in every universe. Although there's like two universes here, really, maybe three.
I don't think of it in terms of different universes, it's just time travel.
Ah, well, it's different. It's still, you know, things go differently every time they...
It's alternate timelines, at least, which is kind of a midway point, I guess.
That's true, but they never go down like the Back to the Future route of changing too many things and stuff can go wrong.
It's more Groundhog Day.
That's a good point.
When they fuck up, they have to restart. But yeah, I think that's all from me on this film. Do you guys have any final thoughts?
No.
Okay, well, that one was very tight, so we can move on to our next. You don't need to look up availability, I know it.
Oh, it's not available?
It's not available to stream anywhere, but it is on DVD, although I think that's only, I mean, from what I saw, it's only sold on Amazon US, so if you're in the UK, you're screwed. But if you are looking for a digital copy of it, I'm pretty sure copyright has been lifted from this film, so shoot me a DM on Instagram, Twitter, or Letterboxd, and I will provide you with a copy that I've crafted for myself.
All right, should we move on to our next film?
We shall.
Play the trailer. Okay, Yes, Madam is a 1985 film directed by Corey Yuen. Aspirin and Strepsil, two petty thieves, inadvertently become involved in a murder case when they steal items belonging to a murdered man. The man had hidden an important microfilm in his passport, which the thieves pass on to a forger friend, Panadol. Inspector Ng is assigned to the case, along with Inspector Morris from Scotland Yard. The investigation proves too much for the inspectors to catch using legal means. In frustration, they give up their badge and go after Tin, the triad leader, alone.
Do you know who plays the forger Panadol? Who the actor is?
Not off the top of my head.
Tsui Hark, the director of Love in the Time of Twilight.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow.
That's a coincidence.
That's very interesting.
But yeah, the synopsis doesn't mention Michelle Yeoh.
Not really until halfway through, which is, I think, maybe my biggest problem with for all that this film is super important if you want to track the sort of chronology and rise of Michelle Yeoh as a movie star, and that this is her breakout role as a leading lady, I do think that a reasonable complaint is that she isn't central enough to it.
No, she stopped building it, and the title is a reference to her character. It almost feels like the film, I don't know, maybe it's not too confident about having a fully female-led martial arts film. Maybe it's too interested in the more comedic characters. I also think that it's a Sammo Hung production. He also has a cameo in it as the leader of the gang who is in the retirement home. Sammo Hung was making, not unlike Jackie Chan, more comedically skewed martial arts films. And Michelle Yeoh she's the straight man in this film, whereas the Gang of Thieves are more of the funny guys. So it kind of makes sense for the film to care more about them, because I think that was more of the tendency that the producers and the directors had.
It's not that she isn't a part of what makes this film work, because I do think the film does work and it is a very enjoyable and interesting film to watch, especially in terms of martial arts cinema. But I think I went into it thinking more that this would be a Michelle Yeoh central film, and this would be a film where she absolutely dominates, and anything less than that could only be a disappointment because of how good we know Michelle Yeoh to be. Mm-hmm. But, you know, not just maybe not confident that two women could lead, but, you know, two women that hadn't led a film before.
Yeah.
So maybe it's unrealistic to expect her to be as integral to every scene of the film as, say, Jackie Chan might have been at this point in her career. I don't know. What do you think of this film, David?
I mean, I had a lot of fun with this one, too. I mean, I am admittedly lacking in, you know, my knowledge of these movies. Like, and this feels like something I would have loved back in high school, you know, and I would have watched over and over again. But like so many of these movies passed me by. And so, you know, that's why we do what we do, is to find these things and go back and watch them. So I'm really glad that I watched it. But yeah, I do agree. Like, it feels like they weren't sure who they wanted to focus on in making this, you know, and they clearly wanted just a comedy more than anything, because, you know, I felt, again, like I said, with the live action cartoon, like with the last one, I feel like this is also very cartoonish. It, you know, all the guys are just total doofuses, you know, and so it's like they're really funny, and I think the director is more interested in the funny necessarily than let's have this like strong leading lady, even though once, you know, her and Cynthia Rothrock are in the picture, they kick all kinds of ass. But like, you know, I think they're more interested in making a comedy than anything more straightforward.
I think that part of the problem, and it's not that women hadn't had important roles in Hong Kong martial arts films before, but I think that a reservation Corian might have had in making this film is essentially, I need to justify that these two women can, as David said, kick all kinds of ass. So if we also make them funny, that at this, you know, in 1985 might undercut some of that intent. So we kind of have to give the comedy bit to the characters that are allowed to be stupid because we expect less of them. Whereas so much is riding on these two women to be the ultimate badasses that they can't be allowed to look stupid. And like, they do have funny moments, particularly Michelle Yeoh early in the film, where she's literally introduced basically baiting a flasher and then trapping his genitals in a book. But the jokes are always based around how competent she is and how stupid everyone else is, rather than the sort of quirks of her character.
Yeah, and then Cynthia Rothrock's introduction is, they've been chasing this huge guy, this like massive bodybuilder guy around an airport for ages, and then he runs into her, and she's wearing like a flight attendant's uniform. She just rips her skirt and just destroys him. Like, he doesn't even get a punch in. So she's clearly introduced as like a big player.
But I also think that for all that you miss Michelle Yeoh and Cynthia Rothrock, I've got a slight lisp, so it's difficult to pronounce.
That's a difficult name to pronounce.
But for all that we miss them when they're not on screen, I do think that the sort of comedy caper elements do really work in this film.
Well, in terms of action sequences, there's obviously, you know, Yeoh and Rothrock shine, but there are so many sequences set inside of Panado's workshop, which is just this like full of like Rube Goldberg machines and setups and just like little traps laid around.
It's very Pee Wee Herman.
Yeah, it's like a Buster Keaton set, and those scenes are so creative as well.
Yeah, but they use the space so well, and I think this is something I really wanted to talk about in this film, is the comedy works really well in this case, I think more successfully than, for me at least, Love in the Time of Twilight. But what to talk about in terms of the action scenes isn't just how much more engaging it is when you have these actors who are doing their own stunts and are doing them at the height of their abilities as physical technicians, essentially, but also how they incorporate space into these scenes. And that's very true in Panadol's flat. And not to spoil the circumstances of it, but I think we kind of have to talk about the climax climactic final sequence, which is the most martial arts heavy bit in the film. And I think one of the reasons why it is so effective is because it utilizes space so well that everything relies on the exact dimensions and materials available to the participants in the fight and how they adapt their fighting styles to the environment. And I just think that's so cool. And I think when you have fight scenes that are filmed largely in front, not to just rag on contemporary action cinema, but when you have action scenes filmed in front of a green screen, you really, really miss out on that because you can't interact with the environment to give it the sense of viscerality and tactility that you get in a film like Yes, Madam.
Lots of broken glass in that scene.
Okay, yeah. Mm-hmm. So as much as talking about authenticity, it is insane the amount of glass that people just jump through and break through and don't have like cuts all over their body. Mm. But I'm happy to allow it because like they literally do flips through glass and then That's turn cool. up on the other side of a balcony and it's amazing. But yeah, there is too much glass breaking. I will allow that.
There is no such thing as too much glass breaking.
Never, ever, ever. Not to go back on that same John Wick tangent, but I think that that's part of what people are so excited about with these recent John Wick movies is that tangibility of space during the fight scenes and like everything in the scene is real and gets broken and they use as weapons and that's what they're doing here. And I think this is where they're getting that inspiration.
I mean, it's a meme that, you know, John Wick killed a guy with a pencil. Yeah. But the reason why that's effective, and when he actually does that in John Wick 2, sorry, this isn't a John Wick episode, but is that you see someone so at ease with how to use their own body as a weapon. Mm-hmm. And I think that's used so well here.
One film that came out in the past couple of years, and I got reminded of it because the YouTube channel Hot Ones just released their interview with Bob Odenkirk, is Nobody. And in the
which I've not seen, but I've heard it's amazing.
I haven't seen either, but like in the interview, Great. It talks about the amount of work that went into just the idea of having to have his face in frame during the fight scenes required him to go through 2 years of training for that movie.
And
that
and is one something. Heart attack.
Well, that came later. Before,
it didn't,
during,
it probably didn't help that
right.
he.
Yeah.
And then it goes on Hot Ones of all interviews podcasts, but I think that kind of shone a light on how a lot of huge budget productions they sacrifice so much because they can't have the actors even be in the same room as each other. So how are you gonna show their faces during fight sequences?
Well, not to defend these companies, but in a lot of cases it's an insurance reason because. It's
oh no that you, can, you know they you don't have the actors actually fight I get
oh yeah
that.
Yeah that's
I get that.
But like you can't yeah. like get them injured ever since Robert Downey Jr. broke his ankle on the set of Iron Man 3 they are super super careful just because it holds up especially on a very intense big budget production it oh, can
that
hold
that timeline makes a lot of sense too I mean those movies yeah. got way worse after that point
no it's exactly but particularly the action sequences
yeah
it's because of them realizing these actors' faces and needing to have them in good condition, not just for the film, but also for the press tour. And it ruins the sort of trajectory of the film, especially when the plots of those films became more and more stage managed so they could line up with each other. You couldn't work around an actor's injury like you did in Iron Man 3 without sort of ruining the next three films.
They should have just gotten Tom Cruise to play Iron Man. That's the answer.
No,
breaks an ankle, just do the jump again.
Yep.
She actually stopped when he broke an ankle during, was it Mission Impossible 7? I don't remember.
I honestly have no idea, but that now that's a timeline that's interesting. But to go back to this film and the action in this film, I also really appreciate how different, they're both equally impressive as martial artists, but how different their style is. And even if they weren't obviously very physically different, they have Cynthia Rothrock, her background is as a competitive martial arts fighter, and you see that her fights, they look like they hurt the people that she hits. And obviously she's not actually hitting people because she's a professional, but there's a real power and a real weight to every kick and every punch, and it's really cool to watch. On the other hand, you have Michelle Yeoh, whose background isn't in martial arts, it's in ballet and it's in dance, and her movement, and we sort of touched on this before when we talked about the differences between Jackie Chan and Michelle Yeoh as martial arts stars, is that she is so controlled and she is so graceful and she is so balletic that you have these things that the spectacle is more the way she is moving into the moves rather than the strength of the moves themselves. And I think having both of them is a really good visual balance.
Absolutely. They really balance each other out, and they both bring so much to each of those fight scenes. And they really just are so overpowered over all these bad guys, though. Like but that leads into the comedy of it. But it's also, again, I don't want to keep bringing up John Wick here, but it comes back to that thing of like the one guy versus, you know, a thousand. Like these two women, just they're just cannon fodder, these people. You know, for them to just
they're red shirts.
Yeah, it's amazing. And I like this kind of action comedy where it's like you just love the ridiculousness of that.
I agree, but also if anyone could beat up a room full of 100 men, it would be Michelle Yeoh, or it would be Keanu Reeves.
Sure.
Like, yeah. You believe that they can do it because you believe in them. And yeah. I think sometimes that is the power of having a movie star. Yes. Whereas obviously nobody, because it's Bob Odenkirk, who has a more comedy background, it's sort of inverted and played, from what I understand, more ironically. But if you buy into the reality of it, then it is extremely enjoyable and extremely fun. I mean, we should probably wrap up this section in a sec, but I do just want to quickly talk about the bad guys that they're fighting. And the bad guys are also, you know, very skilled martial artists and martial arts actors. There is this one character, is he Mad Dog or Wild Dog?
Oh, Mad Dog, I think.
There's this one character, Mad Dog, who looks like he has a very fake mustache. Mm-hmm. And it made me wonder, just the way he's dressed and the way he's made up, is he meant to look like Saddam Hussein?
So just double checking the name, he's billed as, with two names, Big Mustache and Mad Dog. So
well, 1985, people have a feeling of what Saddam Hussein looked like.
I think he's, I don't know.
Was he at the peak of his infamy? Yeah, he was president of Iraq from 79 to 2003.
Huh. So they must have been playing off of that for sure.
I know, but for some reason I just couldn't get that out of my head. I also, the thing we're talking about is that if you're kind of used to Michelle Yeoh, who has like a very iconic look from the 90s onwards, it is weird seeing her with a very, very period-specific style. It's not just super 80s with the hair and the polo shirts and everything. It's specifically like Western and probably, you know, more British 80s style. Because the other thing to remember when you watch Hong Kong cinema from before the late 90s is that Hong Kong was very tied to Britain as a former colony before it sort of more incorporation into the PRC.
Well, it's called the Royal Hong Kong Police.
Yeah, exactly. And it's such a weird reminder that, oh, for a very long time, Hong Kong was sort of like, I don't know, the Falkland Islands or Gibraltar.
Well, a former guest of the podcast, Victor Fan, he was born in Hong Kong in the 70s when it was very much a British colony, and he went to boarding school and all of that. Like, he followed the British system of education growing up there.
David, have you seen Police Story 3 Supercop?
That is like one of those movies, like I said, I would have loved this in high school. It's one of those movies I'm sure I probably watched back then, but it's been like 20+ years if I have.
So that was sort of Michelle Yeoh's big comeback as a movie, because she spent a few years after she got married not really acting, and then when she got divorced she sort of made a comeback by basically playing the second lead in this Jackie Chan movie. Mm-hmm. And I do think that as much as I think this film is very charming and really entertaining, and I think the fight scenes are so excellent and the comedy works really well for me, I think that if you want a film that is based around the characters who are also doing the martial arts, I think Supercop is also a good film. But I just thought it was a little too well known to qualify as an alternate pick. But interestingly, in that, Jackie Chan is playing the Hong Kong police detective, whereas Michelle Yeoh is playing a police officer from mainland China. And so it's which is kind of a really interesting inversion. It's more of like a culture clash movie, which I sort of wish that this film did more, between Cynthia Rothrock, who isn't British, she's American in real life, and she speaks Cantonese throughout the whole movie.
Yeah.
But you could have examined the culture clash between the Hong Kong police and Scotland Yard a bit more. Mm-hmm. But because that's not the interest of the film, they don't go in that direction. But if the stuff that sort of may have left you wanting in Yes Madam, I feel as if that itch could be scratched quite well by Supercop. It's great. Yeah. It's also a great film.
Yeah.
But I really like this film as well. I don't want to, it's difficult with it as a film recommendation podcast where you want to convince people to seek out these other films, but you also are having conversations with your friends essentially, so you will touch on things you like less about them. So
it's like, you know, if I look up a film's review and I want to watch it, but the reviews are not all five stars, it doesn't, you know, dissuade me from watching it.
Oh, I know, but yeah. in the moment of having the conversation, when you kind of check yourself and think, oh, I've just spent a lot of time seemingly slagging off this film, it's like, which may not be how it comes across once it's edited and everything, and people listen to it in the whole context, but you are aware of, oh, am I doing a bad job recommending a film by criticizing it?
We spent like 10 minutes just talking about how great the action scenes were.
That's true.
A great reason to seek out this film is that the Criterion Channel put it out together with basically all the other early Michelle Yeoh films. It's almost like they knew what was coming at the Oscars in advance, yeah. And they put their hands forward.
It would have been very embarrassing I wouldn't have minded if Cate Blanchett had won, because I think her performance is great, but they specifically, you know, put out Halle Berry, who I think is the only other woman of color to win the Best Actress Oscar, and to have her then not give it to Michelle Yeoh
and instead give it to Anthony Hopkins, who wasn't even there. That would have been embarrassing.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it would have been a bit like that. But yeah, I really like this movie, and I think if you're interested in watching more of Michelle Yeoh's Hong Kong stuff, I think this is a really good place to start. Mm-hmm. But it is by no means where that journey should end.
No, David, any final thoughts?
Great score.
That's
the only other thing I wanted to mention. Yeah, awesome 80s score. So yeah,
for sure.
All right, availability, as Francesco said, it's on the Criterion Channel, which you have access to if you're in the US, and not a great lot else if you're in the UK. There is a lot of DVD and Blu-ray copies knocking around if you still buy physical media.
Yeah, and we're still waiting on our VPN sponsorship before recommending you to use a VPN and get the Criterion Channel, even if you're in the UK. It's as simple as that.
All right. All right, let's move on to our fourth and final film, our third pick. David, let's play the trailer for your film.
Un, dos, tres, cuatro.
Hi, welcome back. Tonight, I'll show you how dreams are prepared.
Love, friendships, relationships, and all those ships.
Hello? Are you trying to mock me on the air?
If you close the door.
So what's your name?
Stefan.
Stefan. Stephanie. Stefan, Stephanie. Click, click, catch, match. She has no boyfriend.
Shine out. That you can see real life in 3D.
Isn't life already in 3D?
Yeah, but come on. All the people
are dancing. Stephanie is a talented composer. Oh,
really?
A pretty girl with talent that deserves to be mentioned.
Yeah.
So The Science of Sleep from 2006, written and directed by Michel Gondry. It's about Stefan, a man entranced by his dreams and imagination, is love-struck with Stephanie, a French woman, and feels he can show her his world.
Okay, so what do we say about this film?
I did not expect to love this film this much.
It's a wild one, for sure. I mean, the first thing I think is important to mention is that this is Michel Gondry's narrative follow-up, because he had also done a documentary with Dave Chappelle in between, but to Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, which is one of the best movies of all time, which he co-won Best Original Screenplay for with Charlie Kaufman, who of course was the main writer on that. But this was him writing and directing his own film after that. I think it's pretty safe to say shares some similarities with Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind.
For sure. It feels, I don't know, maybe because it's a French production, not an American production, it feels a bit smaller. Also, it's got a very young Gael Garcia Bernal and Charlotte Gainsbourg, who are, they're just amazing, the both of them.
You may know her from Lars von Trier's Nymphomaniac Volume 1 and 2.
Yeah, she was in a bunch of Lars von Trier stuff. You may know, it was my first time actually seeing Gael Garcia Bernal not do a role in Spanish. I was surprised by his English. It was great.
I think before I'd sort of, I mean, I obviously knowing it was Michel Gondry, I made the connection between Eternal Sunshine, but I hadn't quite looked or considered the years. So because I was watching, and because, like you said, it was French, I sort of assumed it was his precursor, because the traditional arc is you make your English language film in America and that makes you a big director, rather than then you go home and make your small, very personal.
Sure.
But that's, you know, I guess that's who Michel Gondry is.
Yeah, absolutely. And he's had a very interesting career. I mean, we could talk about like all of the various projects he's worked on after this. But I mean, just to talk about this film, you know, the first thing first, like the reason why I picked it is because of the dream sequence with the big hands was like the immediate like visual reference that brought me to the hot dog fingers in Eternal Sunshine. I mean, in Everything Everywhere All at Once, you know, it, it's just such a work of like weirdness and imagination and layers of dreams upon reality and not knowing what starts where and what ends wherever and everything blending together. And so while it's not exactly a multiverse movie, it certainly has those layers where you could be in any place at any time while watching this movie.
There's some truly amazing stop motion animation in those dream sequences that is just so out there and so creative.
Yeah, even like down to using cellophane for water just as like a visual signifier that this is a dream and not the reality of the film.
Yeah. And I think that like the some of the more weird and wild moments in Everything Everywhere All at Once, like Michelle Yeoh yelling and you know, it switching between all the different multiversal versions of herself, and you get that like weird stop motion animated visual stuff like that, feels like it's like right in line with, like, you know, inspired by Michel Gondry and what he was doing here.
Yeah, I mean, I think that even though Michel Gondry as a director isn't as well known as Eternal Sunshine is, I think that the influence of Eternal Sunshine on a generation of filmmakers is extremely unavoidable, particularly with directors with a more sort of esoteric bent like the Daniels.
Yeah, absolutely. It's always so difficult when people ask, what's your favorite director? And I'm like, well, it's Charlie Kaufman, but he's like, you know, it's actually all these other people, Spike Jones and Michel Gondry, are actually doing the directing for most of his project.
Yeah, although I think Synecdoche, New York is a masterpiece.
Oh, absolutely.
I mean, that's, when someone asks you, just quick tangent, but if someone asks you who's your favorite director, do you say who's your favorite person who has directed? Or do you mean purely in the role of director? Because it's a very different question.
Yeah, absolutely. I wish people would ask me the latter, so it would be easier for me to just say Charlie Kaufman, you know.
But yeah, so talking a bit about the narrative in this film, I thought it was very interesting because it does have a lot of those romantic comedy setups, but it doesn't seem like the direction is going towards the two characters have to be with each other. As a matter of fact, much like Eternal Sunshine, we see them kind of drifting away from each other, and we see a lot of toxicity in this relationship as well, which I thought was interesting because this film makes you identify with Gael Garcia Bernal's character so much. Like, you're literally inside his brain for most of it. But that's also why you find yourself almost like screaming at the screen, like, stop, don't do that. What are you doing?
Yeah, but I don't think it ever becomes sort of, it never pulls the rug out from under you to make you not sympathize with him, even when he's doing things which you may not do or you might consider toxic. To me, at least, I watched it just viewing it as, these are the struggles to be close to a person with mental health problems.
Yeah.
Which, you know, it's very cute the way that visually it's represented, but I don't think it ever shies away from the fact that this person is extremely damaged. I mean, from the beginning, it's revealed that he's come to France because his father's died, and he's clearly been very triggered by that, and also just by the longstanding effects of what seems to be his parents' quite acrimonious divorce.
Well, I don't think he's ever made a victim because of
no,
that.
No, I don't think he's a victim, but I think he has, his life has had a trajectory that has led him to develop certain defense mechanisms that puts him at odds with leading a healthy life.
But I think that his main flaw, as it were, his main obstacle, as it were, is it's almost like a condition, it feels like, of having these incredibly lucid dreams that gradually he's unable to tell apart from reality. And in these dreams, because they are dreams, he projects a lot of his insecurities, a lot of his deeper, more deeply buried desires, some of the desires that he, you know, most of us normally suppress, and for good reason, they just surface with him. And so every small thing can turn into a huge ordeal because it arises in his subconscious and then it's made manifest in his real life.
I found also that, and it's something that I really sympathized with, is the sort of creation of imaginary versions of people that are based on your limited understanding of, sorry, I mean, everyone's understanding of people is limited by what they see of the people, and you can't ever know, but he kind of shuts himself off to understanding more about people than his initial impression, because to him, he spent all this time with the version of them in his head, in his lucid dreams.
Absolutely.
And not quite in the same way, but I'm sure we've all done that to some extent or another.
Yeah, everybody becomes just like an archetype or whatever, and that's like the only version of them that exists to him.
Yeah, that can also be a real problem with people who are film obsessives. that they tend to see humans through a lens of tropes.
Yeah, your narrative arc has been quite shit this year, Charlie.
I agree. I agree, but we're not going to talk about that.
When I watched it this time, because I hadn't seen it in years, and there was something that kind of popped out to me, and I could be way off base on this, but it was just something that I just kind of picked up on. I was wondering what you guys' thoughts were, but I was wondering if, to a degree, he wants to be Stephanie. Like, he like sees her as like a better version of himself, and like, you know, maybe like actually like she's into all the same stuff as him, but she's a little bit more grounded and okay in her skin and okay in her life and has friends and all that stuff. And you know, even with their names being basically very similar, and then to the very end when it ends with him just like slipping into her bed and you know, just he's kind of in a weird way at peace, like in that moment, even though it's come after such difficult moments, you know, in the film. I was wondering if either you picked up on that at all.
I really it's such an interesting take, but I have to admit it's not something that I considered for a moment, partly because he spends a lot of the film imagining, and never once in the language of the film is Stephanie not a separate person from him. I think he has a lot of problems with identity, but I think his fixation on Stephanie is more based, at least in my interpretation, I'm not saying your interpretation is invalid at all.
Sure.
But my interpretation of it was more that he wants her to, he wants someone to take care of him. And it's not that he wants her to replace him or he wants to be her. It's more that he wants her to fill the role that his mother didn't fill in his life.
Sure.
So you could say it's quite Oedipal, which brings in a whole other set of identity problems. But I never got the sense that he wanted to either be her or be like her, or that there was, I mean, I'm not saying that yours wasn't explicitly trans reading of it, but I certainly didn't get that element of it.
More of a transidentitarian reading.
Exactly.
I think that their gender, they're very coded within their own gender. Like, their gender is important to who their character is. But I almost think like there is something that the more he's slipping away from reality, the more Stefan falls back into a lot of the more male-coded gender tropes that are espoused by people like his co-worker. And it almost feels like a self-defense mechanism in a way, like trying not to slip away. But I like this dynamic that they have, where, as you said, David, she's into all the same like quirky, weird stuff as him, but she's much more grounded. Because this doesn't feel like a film where, you know, guy with a boring white-collar job finds a manic pixie dream girl and she pulls him out. Here, it's more like he is quite literally a manic pixie dream boy who is trying to whisk her away from her grounded reality. And you're also right, Charlie, that she does almost fill a maternal role for him. Because a lot of the stuff he pulls, like, most people would have just dropped him or outright called the cops on him, especially some moments later in the film. But she has this almost like nourishing attitude towards him, where it almost doesn't feel like she's attracted to him in that sense. It's more like she wants to take care of him.
But you also don't really get the sense that he's that. Obviously, he has this, in his mind at least, a very deep connection with her, even when they've only known each other for a few hours. But his interest in her doesn't feel primarily sexual. And when he tries to code it as sexual, it feels extremely uncomfortable and extremely forced. And she picks up on that, and she knows that he's not doing it to be, because that's who he is. She knows something's off whenever he gets overly sexual. But I also think that she never, for as much as there is toxicity in their relationship, I think it's also worth noting out that he's never honest in a very, in a grounded way. He can say like, oh, I want to marry you, and that feels sincere rather than honest. He never asks her out, and eventually she's the one that asks him out. It's never clear what their dynamic is, because the communication isn't there. Partly because to him, all the communication has happened already in his dreams.
Right, right. Yeah, he's already like kind of lost track of where he's at in the point of this particular relationship. He doesn't even know at what stage he's at yet.
And he projects a lot of stuff on her. There's this moment early in the film where he writes this unhinged letter in a dream. And I don't know if you guys have ever like had dreams where you're trying to write a text or you know, type something or anything. It is one of the worst sensations you can feel, just trying to like push your way through like typing something, and it feels like your brain is exploding. But he actually writes a letter in his dream and then puts it under her door. She reads it but doesn't tell him that she's read it, and when he retrieves it, he thinks that she hasn't seen it. And then later on, when she quotes the letter back to him, instead of thinking, oh, she's probably read it before I took it back, he's like, we're probably connected in the dream world. She knows what I'm dreaming about. And that's the conclusion that he jumps into. He's projecting so much onto her.
Yeah.
but it's never like, I don't know, 500 Days of Summer, there is a lot of projection that is shown to be explicitly toxic and the sort of stuff that we champion in a lot of romantic heroes. The stuff they do when you actually break it down is pretty problematic. This, it never feels like, on the one hand, this is normal behavior that in a lesser movie we would celebrate, but it also never feels like it is born specifically out of, you know, explicitly male toxicity. It's a very specific set of circumstances and a very specific dynamic that the two of them have, and it makes the film extremely interesting to watch, not least because even though they haven't had the conversations that they've had in real life that they've had in his head, she understands at least some of where he's coming from and some of why he does the things he does when he's being himself in a way that other people don't, or at least other people don't have time for. Mm-hmm. It's a really lovely film, and there were times where it really, I did, sort of out of nowhere, just sort of hit me in my gut. And so thank you. And when that happens, that's really wonderful when you find a film like that. So thank you, David, for bringing that on the podcast, because I'm not sure. I mean, I really like Eternal Sunshine of the Spotless Mind, but until this, I haven't seriously considered going through Michel Gondry's entire filmography.
Yeah, well, Be Kind Rewind up next, because that one's great too.
All right, yeah. Maybe I will.
One last point I want to make on this is one comparison with Everything Everywhere. Kind of what you mentioned, David, earlier in regards to Love in the Time of Twilight, just the merging of styles and genres. And here, there seems to be quite a lot of reverence to the French New Wave in quite a few scenes, to Godard especially. There's a scene where he's chased around by the police in cardboard cars. And the use of changing frame rates, which once again were experimented with during the French New Wave, but then they're also a huge part of Everything Everywhere. Just the you know, the slow-mo and speed up sequences. So yeah, that was just another thing that I realized was very reminiscent of that.
Absolutely.
Okay, so do we have any last thoughts?
I'm good, David.
Well, I think we covered
good
that.
To go. All right. Availability: you can rent and buy this film on Amazon, Apple TV, Google Play, Chili, and YouTube. All right, so just to finish up, what we like to ask people is, if Everything Everywhere All at Once is the main course of a meal, which of our three picks is dessert? David, if you have an answer, why don't you go first?
Oh, it's a tough one. So I almost, as much as I really like The Science of Sleep, which I brought to the conversation, I almost want to go Love in the Time of Twilight on this one, just because it's such a unique film that I probably never would have even heard of if it wasn't for this conversation. So I think it's worth seeking out, and it's good and weird.
I think Love in the Time of Twilight is the film you watch before Everything Everywhere, because they're very, very similar, but I don't know, Everything Everywhere is almost like the more complete version or the more updated version of it. As a film I'd watch as dessert, I probably have to say The Science of Sleep, because it does feel, I don't know, I'm not going to elaborate on this. It's a dessert movie. It's an end of a meal movie, kind of movie. Whereas, yes, Madam's scratches more of the itch of just the action, and the genre set pieces in Everything Everywhere, and just the Michel Yeoh greatness. So I think all three of these films are just touch on so many different aspects of the central film that, honestly, like, do what we did last week, just watch all four of them one after the other, and you'll have a good time, I'm sure.
Yeah, I mean, I'm tempted to say Science of Sleep, but I think that because Everything Everywhere All at Once, to me at least, is so emotionally impactful, and as I've said, The Science of Sleep kind of does the same, and not that you would have to watch them consecutively, but I really enjoy the sort of wild theatricality of Love in the Time of Twilight, not just that it is set in a Cantonese opera company, but also the sort of visual and stylistic lengths it goes to. And yes, Science of Sleep does that as well, but there is a real joy in Love in the Time of Twilight, which I think is not just the name of one of the characters in Everything Everywhere All at Once, but I do just really enjoy the out there and originality of Love in the Time of Twilight.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, there is something to be said about the fact that the more cynical aspects of The Silence of Sleep, you could put those before Everything Everywhere or after, depending on whether you need a downer after having watched Everything Everywhere, or you need an upper after having watched The Silence of Sleep. But yeah, no, all three of these were such amazing picks, and likewise I wouldn't have found any of them, including my own, if it weren't for other people's.
Well, yours would have been impossible to find.
I wouldn't have known of it, honestly, if it was recommended to me by someone else. So yeah, that's great.
All right, well, thank you, David, so much for coming on. It's been an absolute joy talking to you, and I hope that we can collaborate again very soon.
And where can people follow you and your podcast?
Yeah, absolutely. Thanks so much for having me. And people can find Piecing It Together wherever they listen to podcasts, and follow me on social media at PiecingPod. And of course, check out the episode we did with you guys on Guillermo del Toro's Pinocchio.
I was about to recommend the episode for no particular reason at all, but you just spoiled the reason that, yeah, we're on it.
Because Ciao Papa is a banger.
Because Ciao Papa
is
a banger.
It sure is. Absolutely. Hopefully we'll get you guys back on Piecing It Together again soon, too.
Oh, yeah. Anytime.
Well, it's a quid pro quo. All right, well, that's all from us. Thanks, as always, to our producer, Jade Corbett, artist Molecule, for our lovely logo. You can follow us online at BCU Watch Pod on Twitter, at BCU Watch Podcast on Instagram. Thank you very much, Francesco.
Thank you, Charlie.
And thank you for listening.